Good morning. I would like to invite you all to take your Bibles, open up with me to the book of Hebrews, and turn along to chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12, we will begin reading there in just a few moments. Again, we want to extend another welcome and thanks to all those who are able to be with us this morning. Again, it is always a pleasure to get to be with God's people, our church family here, and the encouragement that we can bring each other. And we are always glad to have visitors with us. Hope that you're lifted up in our service, and we invite you to come back if you're able. Another opportunity at 4 o'clock this afternoon or any time that you are with us in the area. For this morning, though, we're going to be drawing our lesson from Hebrews chapter 12. But before we get into the text, I have to begin with a mildly embarrassing confession. And that is that I am an absolute sucker for cheesy sports movies. Have any of you seen, I think maybe Focus on the Family put it out, there was a movie called The Pistol about Pistol Pete Maravich. And I know at least one person has seen that. And we recorded it on VHS, and I watched it so much that the tracking button would no longer function, and it was worn out, and there were just lines across the screen. I love those kinds of movies. And there's always a part in those kinds of movies where the person who's struggling to compete and trying to make it through, and it looks as though they're going to falter, and they look over and they see their mentor figure in the crowd, and they sort of smile or give them the thumbs up, and that empowers them to go ahead and finish their competition and maybe just get the victory. So you know the kinds of moments in those movies that I'm talking about. And we recognize that those are cheesy and they are ham-fisted. And yet, for some reason, those things resonate with us. They actually impact us on an emotional level. Now, why is that? I think it is in part because, although they are cheesy, we no doubt have experienced those types of moments on some level. We have experienced the encouragement of having someone cheer us on, of telling us that we can endure. And so when some form of difficulty came, their presence was what enabled us to go through that moment of difficulty. And so those emotions and the way that they resonate with us are part of what make Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 1 so impactful. Because as the author in the previous chapter has brought to our attention all of these different men and women and their faith and the way it enabled them to achieve a great victory, we are called on to envision all of them as populating the stands or the seats in the Colosseum as watching us finish our race. And we are called on to think of them as cheering for us, as wanting to see us finish, and we think of that crowd as just getting larger and larger as every years go by, and those that we love who have died in the faith continue to swell that crowd. And so the author writes in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 1, "Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." Now, that is a wonderful picture, and it is meant to lift us up. But included in that encouragement is the acknowledgement that we are in need of encouragement. The text says we've got encumbrances that we need to cast aside, that each of us deal and struggle with sin that all too easily entangle us, cause us to trip and fall. And so this race is one that requires endurance. For the next three Sundays, this is the topic that we're going to be looking at. This morning, of course, our text is from Hebrews chapter 12. We're going to be following along with the brethren as they are called to remember the exhortation that they have forgotten. The following Sunday, we're going to go to James chapter 5 as we look at the example of those who give us the patience that we need to face difficulties. And then finally, we're going to go to 1 Peter chapter 3. We're going to discuss the way in which our interactions with the difficulties that we face prepare us and equip us to evangelize and to be a light for others. But this morning, we're going to be focusing on Hebrews chapter 12. Now, as we've said, Hebrews chapter 11 sets the stage for chapter 12. And you'll recall that in that list of all of the men and women from the prior chapter, we've got a pretty diverse cast of characters. Their backgrounds are different. The difficulties that they faced are different. And as such, those accounts affect us in different ways. Now, some of those strike us in such a way that they are intended for us to be impressed with what they could do with their faith. And so look at what they did through faith. You can do that too. But other accounts in chapter 11 strike us from a different angle. We are inspired by the sacrifices that these people were willing to make, to look at those who had died and suffered for their faith. Those stories evoke strong emotions within us as we consider, if this is what they were willing to do for their faith, then how could I be willing to do any less? And so it's that second perspective of stirring our emotions in a very special way that is carried on as the text continues in verse 2 of Hebrews chapter 12. Speaking of running the race with endurance, he says in verse 2, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin. So what is the author saying as we introduce the text? Now, we want to, of course, keep in mind that our audience, the original audience of the text, this is a group of people who are facing difficulties. They have suffering that comes with being a Christian, perhaps everyday trials, but they have questions. Why is it that I am having to face these things? And the author calls on them to think about Jesus for a moment. Consider the hostility that Jesus endured. Really, opposition leading to death is what the author has in mind. Now, verse 4 acknowledges, you've faced some hostility too. You've been through things. You've made sacrifices for your faith. You have suffered for your faith. You too have had those who have opposed you. You've resisted. But in all that, you're not dead yet. You have not done what the Lord did. That's not meant to be a dismissive statement. The author is not just, brushing away any sort of conversation or trying to downplay what they've done. But it's meant to be a sobering reminder of the reality that we all face. And that is, whatever it is we have given for the Lord, however much we are willing to give for the Lord, if we are still here living, we haven't given everything that we could. And so for those who found themselves feeling, I'm at the end of my rope, I just don't know if I can endure this any longer, then it is meant to be a startling statement. We're sort of hitting the reset button on our thinking. The author, I keep wanting to say Paul. I'm making a concerted effort to say the author. So the author, he's calling on them to stop thinking about how much they are suffering and give more thought as to what they are supposed to learn from their suffering. The difficulties that they faced as Christians were starting to become one of those encumbrances that are mentioned in verse 1 of the chapter. But verse 5 says, you have forgotten something. You have forgotten the exhortation. And if they were going to run their race with endurance, there were certain truths about facing difficulty that they were going to have to relearn. And so the purpose of our study this morning is to learn alongside them and to be reminded about three facts regarding difficulties that will help us in running our race. Read with me, if you would, in chapter 12, beginning in verse 5. And you have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. First truth that the text calls to our mind is that discipline is a sign of God's love. Now, I think that we have to perhaps adjust our thinking just a little bit to see it that way. We have to enable ourselves to consider discipline in a positive light. I think we at least need to acknowledge that our culture at least has some background influence on the way in which we perceive discipline. You know, is our tendency to view discipline as a positive or a negative? Well, it's usually negative. Discipline means I've gotten in trouble. And so how can that be a proof of God's love? Culturally speaking, we've come to have a very skewed perspective of discipline, one that is born out of a picture of discipline that is abusive and fleshly. And so if the media is going to portray, in a book or a movie, someone who does any sort of discipline, it's usually a very surly-looking, strict school marm or schoolmaster who comes in with a long switch. Or maybe it's a father who's sort of standing in the shadows and he's slowly taking off the belt with a scowl and he says, this is going to hurt me. No, he doesn't. He says, this is going to hurt you more than it's going to hurt me. And so we have this fictionalized picture that discipline cannot be associated with love because discipline is abuse, and yet God's discipline is a sign of his non-abusive love. And so if we're going to fully appreciate this point, we need to make sure that those cultural influences are set aside so that we can appreciate the point that the author is making. But what is discipline in our text? Well, we want to understand that there is more than one type of discipline, for sure. And God uses discipline to perform different functions. Sometimes, as we'll see in a moment as the chapter continues, discipline is used to prepare us for future growth. But other times, God uses discipline as a course correction. He either sends or allows some sort of trial or difficulty to enter our lives in the hopes that we will learn from it and get drawn back into line. But the core fact that the author is stressing is that whatever our situation is, we are to be reminded that God always performs discipline from a position of love. In other words, it is always carried out in a way that is for our benefit. It is always done in a way that builds us up instead of tearing us down. And I would submit to you that that is not an easy task to perform. I would draw your minds to a couple of examples. You know, we don't often think of God's most faithful prophets of needing any form of discipline. But as our brother Shannon reminded us last month, they are men with natures like ours. And sometimes they got discouraged. And sometimes they had doubts, and God used discipline to bring them back into line. He even had to do such with Jeremiah, again, one of his most faithful prophets. You may recall Jeremiah chapter 15 and verse 18 as the place where Jeremiah considers, has the Lord become an unfaithful or a deceptive stream to me? I want you to consider God's response to Jeremiah in chapter 15, verse 19. Therefore, thus says the Lord, If you return, then I will restore you. Before me you will stand, and if you extract the precious from the worthless, you will become my spokesman. They, for their part, may turn to you, but as for you, you must not turn to them. Now I want you to consider this question for a moment. Supposing that you were in a position of authority, as God is in this account, and you have people who are under you, and you've got someone who's just not in line, and they're just not doing what you've asked them to do, would it not be so much easier to simply say, all right, I'm done with you, you get out, I'll get somebody in here who will do what I tell them? I think that would be the easier path. If I have the choice between having to correct and build somebody up, or simply saying, all right, you had your shot, you blew it, I've got someone else who can do this just as well as you, I might say so long. So why does God make the harder choice? Why does God say, I'm not done with Jeremiah, I can discipline him, I can bring him back to be useful? Is the answer not because of God's love for Jeremiah? Have you ever stopped to think about how much God loved King Ahab? That's not a trick statement. You know, we don't think of him in this way. But Ahab was still a part of God's people. Ahab was part of God's covenant. He didn't act like it, but he was. And I would suppose that, again, you know, if you remember Shannon's lesson talking about how much Ahab flaunted his wickedness, I would suppose that we could rightfully expect God to look at somebody that wicked and say, well, you're not going to be king very long. Yeah, what does God do with Ahab? Well, first, he sends him a warning. Then he takes away the reign, but then he gives it back. Then he gives Ahab victory over his enemies. And then even when Ahab continues to be petulant and plays a part in the murder of Naboth, he sends Elijah to go and rebuke him again. What is God trying to do? Consider God's response to Ahab's lament in 1 Kings chapter 21 and verse 29. Do you see how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he has humbled himself before me, I will not bring the evil in his days. I will bring the evil upon his house in his son's days. God loved Ahab. He wanted to spare even Ahab. He wanted to show whatever mercy he could. Now, Ahab may not have felt love, because he didn't appreciate the discipline of the Lord. God was trying to achieve a result. You know, we are primed by various influences to think that whenever we encounter some kind of discomfort, well, that's a sign that God just doesn't care. But when God allows us to experience difficulty, whether that is preventative or corrective in nature, we would do well to remember that those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines. The text continues in chapter 12 and verse 7 of the book of Hebrews. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? But if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Now, some of you are probably going to go home and eat lunch, but others, myself included, are going to go have somebody make it for us. And maybe, while you're in there, none of your children will do this, but hypothetically speaking, there is a child in the restaurant who does not belong to you, and you hear at the next table them saying to their parents, I don't want that. I don't like that. I want something else. Well, Junior, this is what you're going to get. Well, in that case, and then they throw it in the floor. And maybe they kick and they pound on the table. Now, how many of you are going to get up out of your seat and pick up Junior and administer discipline? I know there are a couple of you who might, and I stand ready to pay your bill. But most likely what you're going to do is kind of turn your head to the side. You might sort of cough very loudly and indicate you really ought to do something about that. But because it is not your child, that's really the extent of it. But in that realm of fiction, suppose it was your own child who misbehaved. That they were engaging in that behavior. Well, now it's a different story. Because it is your child, you have responsibility to correct. Because it is your child, you now have the responsibility to instruct because they belong to you. Now we would do well to add that there is another sense in which discipline can be used, and one in which it is used in this very text. Discipline, in addition to punishment, carries the connotation of instruction, of education. For instance, another way of asking those who are going off to school in the fall what they're studying is, what is your area of discipline? What are you going to be learning about? Now, in the same way, who are you responsible for educating? Do you pay for your child to be educated, or do you pay for someone else's child to be instructed? Generally speaking, you're responsible for educating your own children. And so, to the point of the author, let's suppose that a man has two sons. One of those sons is from his wife. Another son is from a relationship with a concubine or indiscretion. Now, he has two sons, and maybe both of them live with him, and yet only one of them is considered to be legitimate. Only one of them is considered to be an heir. And although he has two sons, which of those children is he going to ensure is instructed and educated and brought up to be able to inherit his household? The one who is legitimate or the one who is illegitimate? The question that is posed by the author in our text is, do you want to be considered a legitimate child of God or not? If you want to be a legitimate child of God, then you will receive the Father's instruction. Again, verse 8, if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, who is all? All of God's legitimate children. And so if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Well, one might say, I don't like that. I don't think that's fair or right. You know, after all, if I'm the legitimate child, should I be the one who's having to undergo discipline? I don't like this. Have you considered that even the good Israelites bore the burden of the wilderness? You can maybe put good in quotation marks there. But Numbers 14:29 tells us that those who were 20 years and older were going to drop dead in the wilderness. But the text doesn't say, and all the rest of you just sort of wait over here at the border, and then you can go in. In fact, the text really says the opposite of that. In verse 33 of Numbers 14, it says that the children would suffer for the unrighteousness, the unfaithfulness of the previous generation. Now, why is that? Why would God do such a thing? Well, because they were His children. They were the legitimate heirs to the land. And although it may have been unpleasant, those 40 years in the wilderness instructed and prepared them to win a victory that their illegitimate parents could not achieve. And so the trials that we face, these are not a sign that somehow God has disowned us and that we're out of the family. In fact, it's quite the opposite. Trials are a proof of His claim on you. You are His child, and He is trying to instruct you for your betterment. The text continues in verse 9. Furthermore, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subjective to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good so that we may share in his holiness. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. You know, there is a problem that all earthly fathers face. You know, one of the shortcomings of earthly fathers is that sometimes their discipline can seem to be arbitrary or unjust. And that applies for all earthly fathers. Even the best among them in their execution of discipline and instruction make mistakes. Now, for you fellow historians, how many of you have heard of the great injustice of Homestead Hollow? That may be because my life has not yet made it into the history books. But there was an occasion when my family was at the, kind of one of these like Pioneer Day things at a place called Homestead Hollow. And there was a glass sculpture of Garfield's head. I can relate to Garfield. And you had the option of filling Garfield's head with different layers of colored sand. I coveted the glass head of Garfield and its multi-layered colored sand. And so I asked my father on multiple occasions, Dad, can we buy this? Can we buy this? And eventually he said, no, we're not going to get it. Don't even ask me about it again. And so I, the obedient son, said, all right, I won't ask about it anymore. My older sister, the tempter, came in and she said to me, I want to give you some money. And I said to her, no, Dad said not to talk about money anymore. Although I was faithful, all my dad saw when he turned around is me and my sister holding out money. And so my father comes over, and you know, they had a literal woodshed at Homestead Hollow. And I was taken behind it. The great injustice of Homestead Hollow. Now, do I hold that against my dad? Well, you know, he gave me, some of you may be thinking, well, it kind of sounds like it. Look, I just love truth. I don't hold it against my parents because I know that the totality of their relationship with me is we are trying to prepare you for something. We are trying to get you in a specific direction. Now, are there mistakes that are made along that way and little misfires here and there? Well, yes. And yet, we can all mature to a place where we look back with hindsight on our parents and we say, well, they did the best that they could. And we're not saying that to be, well, that wasn't much. We know they did the best that they knew how to do, and they did the best with what they were given in us. Now, the question that the author asks us to consider is, why is it that we can grow to a point of maturity where we can extend that same grace and understanding to our earthly fathers who are just trying to do the best that they know how with what they can, and yet when it comes to God's discipline, we somehow have no understanding. There's no grace that is extended. It ought to be easy to trust God and say He knows what He's doing far more than we can trust our earthly fathers and say, well, they knew what they were doing. They did the best that they could. First of all, the author points out that God does not get it wrong. Whether we are discussing discipline as a form of punishment, where He's bringing us back into line, or if we're talking about discipline from the perspective of just trying to teach us and instruct us, he always gives us what we need. Verse 10 of our text says of our earthly fathers that they disciplined us as seemed best to them. I don't take that to mean that they were just sort of whimsical and capricious with their judgments, but what we've just said, they did the best that they knew how to do and sometimes made mistakes. But that's not true with God. God always does his best, which means he always gets it right. God, on the other hand, always gives us what is for our good, not just what he may think is for our good, like our fathers do, although they may on occasion be mistaken. But second, the author says God's goal is far better. If I can trust that my parents had something good in mind for me here, what about what God has? What is waiting for me on the other side of discipline? The text says it prepares us, verse 10, so that we may share his holiness. What an unparalleled reward. What undeserved grace and mercy to be able to share in the holiness of God. What claim do I have on that? What right do I have on that? I know I don't have any. And so whatever it is that I have to experience to be able to share in his holiness and to enjoy the fruit of peace that comes with righteousness, I should be able to trust my way through that. If I could only learn to set that before my eyes, how little I would complain. But the author, again, does not tell us these things to be dismissive of discipline. He acknowledges all discipline, it is painful in the moment. You know, again, however you want to define that, it seems sorrowful when you are the one who has to go through it. But he tells us these things so that we can look beyond to see the reward that awaits us. He echoes the words of Romans chapter 8 and verse 18. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. See, our brethren are called on to remember their exhortation. Trials, difficulty, all of those things. The author says these are not markers of God's displeasure with you. For one, these are a sign that God loves you and he's attentive to you, giving you what you need. They're not an indication of some great distance that is between us. Far from that, it is an indication of the close relationship that we share, his claim on us as children. He says that these things are not aimless, nor are they arbitrary. They are intended to bring us into greater fellowship with him. So let's challenge ourselves in the week ahead to put this into practice. And I would first call on us to practice giving thanks for whatever discipline and trials we do face. I don't mean that in a sort of glib, well, always look on the bright side sort of mentality. But we need to learn to look for the good in the trial that we face. Because while some of us may have great difficulties right now, for many of us, the trials that we face are relatively minor. And we have to start cultivating now a spirit that can give thanks for difficulty so that when something major comes along, we are not simply swept away. I think there's also a lesson for me and others as parents in here. We try to do the best that we can, but what a good model we're given. What a good example for us to emulate and learn from. For those of us who still have a position of responsibility to instruct and discipline others, strive to follow God's example. And again, in an acknowledgement of the fact that none of this is easier without challenge, We have the responsibility to look out among us and take note of those who may be struggling, with those who are threatening to fall under the encumbrances that they face, to lift them up and to help them remember their exhortation. Discipline is a sign of God's love for us as His children. But it's just one of many. God's love is demonstrated to us every day, but ultimately in the love that He has shown in sending His Son, again, the author and perfecter of our faith whom we look to, who faced that hostility and opposition toward death. And it's because of His willingness to face discipline that each of us have the opportunity to be a child of God, to be a legitimate son and heir. We extend that invitation to those who are here this morning. You can be baptized, enter fellowship with the Lord. And for those of us who have done that, maybe you want prayers or encouragement for the things we're talking about, or you'd like to be built up and prayed for in some other way. But the point is that we are here for you. In any way that we can encourage you, build you up spiritually this morning, we'd ask that you come and stand while we sing.